Welcome to the Coaching Lab Podcast. I'm head coach Matt Dennis, and today we're going to listen in on one of the recent Friday coaches clinics that I held. The topic is six overlooked skills that win games. And whether you're a coach who's taking over a program or you're just trying to take your program to a new level and win those close games, I think you're really going to enjoy this episode. Now, if you haven't been to one of the Friday coaches clinics, head over to CoachMattDennis.com and you can find out when the next one is. If you'd like to listen and watch any of the replays, you can go inside the coaching lab and they're all made available to you there. Welcome to the Coaching Lab Podcast, where basketball coaches build more success in less time by increasing their ability to teach, lead, and coach the players on their team and in their program. Hey, Coach, thanks for joining me for another Friday Coaching Clinic. Today, we're going to be looking at six overlooked skills that win games. These are things that I have found in my time as a coach, as a college coach, as a high school coach, that players, if you don't emphasize them, they don't do them. They know how to do them, and they're not like the sexy things that we see on social media all of the time. They're not the things that the trainers want to show. They're just basic fundamental skills that have to get done to give your team a chance to win. And that's really what we're going to focus on. These six skills are things, they're not going to be groundbreaking, but you probably look back and say, you know what, I've lost a game because of that, or we almost lost a game because of that, and because it wasn't done. And we're going to talk about some of what those skills are and how we make sure that we incorporate them into our practices and into what our teams are doing, into what our players are doing in their development, so that they do happen all the time. Because if you look at teams that win consistently, there's a couple of things that typically happen. One is they could just have a stud of a player. That does happen, especially in high school basketball. The higher levels you get to, the less likely that is to be enough to get your team to win. But if your team has that stud in high school, then there's a chance that you could come out and you may have missed these six skills, or you may have done something really poorly. You just happen to have that elite level athlete. Now, when the athletes are the same, or when you have one team that has a really good athlete that kind of leads their team, but then you come up versus a really good team that doesn't necessarily have an elite level athlete, the playing field can be leveled off quite a bit based on these six skills. And I want to take a look, and we're going to dive into each one of them a little bit, share some insights on them, so that if you have a team that has an elite level athlete, well, make the rest of your team better. So when you get into those big games, into those tournament games, you're going to come out on top. If you're a team that does not have that kind of go-to player that's an elite level player, and you still want to win games, maybe that you shouldn't be in, or on paper that it really shouldn't be much of a game, you're going to have your chance to do that. So we'll share some things as we get going, but let's dive into six overlooked skills that win games. All right. As I alluded to earlier, the first thing is these are not skills that everyone works on. The skills that everybody works on are your shooting and your dribbling skills. You know, every player in any player development goes out there and they work on shooting. They work on their jump shots. They work on their free throws. They work on finishing moves. And you need those. No doubt about it. You have to have those skills, and you have to be able to put the ball in the bucket. Otherwise, you're not going to win games no matter what. The other thing is dribbling. And we see these all the time, whether it's the cone drills, the two ball dribbling drills, the small-sided game type drills that get you handling the ball into different situations. All good stuff, all things that your players need. But these are things players work on, and they're on a player's mind all the time. So if you have a serious basketball player, you don't tell them to go shoot. You don't tell them to go work on their ball handling. You don't tell them that their left hand needs to get better because it's a little bit weaker than the right hand. If you have players who love the game, they're working on their shooting and dribbling. It's that simple. So we're not talking about those things per se. What we want to do is we want to look at skills that players don't work on. That's the easiest way to put it, is just things that players don't work on, but they will make your team better. And they're critical to making that player be a prospect in college, be a prospect for in all conference selection and all region selection, however you do it, all county, all state, however it's done. If your player doesn't have these skills, then they're not going to get on those teams, because the kids who have them are doing the dribbling and the shooting plus these other things. So what we're going to talk about are things that eliminate turnovers. They keep you close in games. They, you know, it's keeping you in those games that are nip and tuck and you're back and forth, and they're going to help you keep the possession alive. That's crucial. Got to keep the possession alive. Can't have a turnover that's going to lead to a bucket, but you also can't stall. You can't freeze. You can't rely on a timeout all the time to keep that possession alive. And then finally, by doing those things, they're going to allow you to win games. And I know in my coaching career, especially early on when I was at the community college level, we played some nationally ranked teams. We were not nationally ranked. If you've been around and you've heard me talk at all, you know that my first year in community college, we were 8-22, not very good. The biggest hurdle that I had to get over was I got hired after recruiting was done. We actually held open gyms and had a couple of recruits that were kind of kids who were waiting on schools. Didn't work out, so we ended up getting them, but that was not the bulk of the team. There was only one returner from the previous team that was coming back because they were so heavy with sophomores at the community college level. Most of them moved on. The next year, we went 22-8. We flipped that around. Part of that was my system. The players learned it. The other was we had to go get players that could compete at that level. But we weren't known for anything. And we had players now that could compete. And we got out there and we played some nationally ranked opponents and we won. And that's what got us on the map and actually ultimately got us into the top five, I believe it was, in that to my second year of coaching. Was beating some teams. So it allowed us to win games. We weren't killing people. We weren't out there, you know, winning by 30 points. We were just winning close games because we knew how to handle certain situations. And we had, you know, we had the skills down in order to win those games. So the first one is jump stops. Seems really simple, but this is something that we're constantly having to work on with our players. We do drills and we'll say you have to get into the paint, 2 feet into the paint. No shots until there's a 2 foot jump stop and a kick out. No shots off of 1 foot that are off balance, things like that. So we give some parameters to our players when we're playing, when we're practicing, but 2 foot jump stops, they do a great job in a couple of things. One is they greatly reduce travels and bad passes. Oftentimes, go back and look at your game tape, is look at the traveling violations that a player gets. And I think it's confusing now for the players because some referees call the gather step, some don't use the gather step. So travels are called inconsistent, at least in our league. I think they're inconsistent. It can be hard on the players. But one thing that's true is a 2 foot jump stop is not a travel. So you come to that 2 foot jump stop, and you've reduced your chances of traveling or getting a violation called against you, but you also reduce the chances of a bad pass. How many times do players get into the lane and they're looking for, you know, a pass to save themselves? They're not looking for a pass to make a play. They're looking for a pass because they got themselves in trouble and now they got to find something. So when they do that, those bad passes equal turnovers. They equal poor shots. They equal, if you have a shot clock, the shot clock violations. But you want to greatly reduce travels, 2 foot jump stops. You want to greatly reduce your bad passes, make sure they have 2 foot jump stops. But then it greatly increases two things as well. It'll greatly increase your assist. If your players come to 2 foot jump stops, there'll be better passes. When you get better passes, your shooters get better shots, and you're going to make more of those. So they'll greatly increase the assist. They will also greatly increase the opportunities to score and get fouled. So the player who went in there, you know, you have a chance for an up and under move, or you have a chance for a defender to run into you, and you know that, so you're using your control of your body to finish. Hey, Coach, let's take a quick timeout. I want to let you know that you can find all of the Friday Coaching Clinic replays and any of the Fall Coaching Clinic replays inside the coaching lab at CoachMattDennis.com. If you're interested in becoming a better coach, you'll have access to a drill vault, you'll have access to the coach's library, and everything that you could possibly need to lead a program. Try out the 3-day free trial now by heading over to CoachMattDennis.com. Well, that'd be another greatly reduce your chances of charging over somebody. 2 foot jump stops while you stop and pop and shoot that shot inside the paint to finish off 2 feet. Lots of great reasons. They allow you to score, but they also allow you to have that chance at a foul. So jump stops are crucial. Incorporate these into anything and everything you do. You can do dribbling drills, add jump stops into it. You're doing any kind of finishing drills, add jump stops into it. You're doing passing drills, add getting to the lane on 2 foot jump stop, and then you're going to kick it out. So a drive and kick situation. Lots of areas to add jump stops. Now, are there times to do 1 foot, go off 1 foot, or to try to finish around somebody? Certainly there are. But at the high school level, more times than not, what I found is players try to do things that are outside of their ability. And when they're outside their ability and they're outside their athleticism, that equals a turnover, that equals a pass out of bounds, that equals a poor pass to an offensive player. So any advantage you have is gone. So jump stops are crucial to keeping that ball where you want it and giving yourself a chance on each possession. Next one that we're going to look at are pivots. Now, again, I told you this stuff wasn't real sexy. It's not stuff you don't see trainers showing their, you know, how to pivot on online. I'm sure they teach it and they talk about it, but it's not the clips that they're showing. The pivot is huge in the development of a player. And if you don't have a player who knows how to use their pivot, then they're taking away the advantage they have. They aren't able to get themselves out of trouble. They're not creating the different spacing that you could against a defender, but they keep you on balance. Pivots keep you on balance. They allow you to get yourself out of trouble is the second thing. And we know this as coaches. This isn't like rocket science stuff that, oh man, I've never taught my players how to pivot. Of course you taught your players how to pivot, but are you emphasizing it? Are you having them do it in drills? Are you putting them in situations where they're getting trapped or where they've picked up the ball or where a bad pass led to the sideline, where they're tightroping the sideline and they've got to use a pivot or they've got to use their movement in order to keep the ball alive or to create space, that kind of thing. And that's the third one, is create space away from a defender. A lot of times players don't use the pivot to go into a defender and then pivot out of it to create a little bit of space. They kind of stand straight up and down, or they pivot away from the defender and allow the defender to close the little bit of gap that you have. So using a pivot to not only create some space when you get the ball, but when you get yourself in trouble, create space away from that defender by pivoting into them and then pivoting away from them is really going to help. And then the fourth one is creates passing lanes. We talk a lot, and I hear this mentioned a lot, kids aren't as good at passers as they used to be. And we'll talk a little bit more about passing here in a second. But one of the reasons is they don't pivot into their passes. They're not pivoting to get a passing angle or to get a passing lane. They're just trying to stand there, or they're just trying to throw it from wherever they are and hope that it gets there. You've got to use pivots to give you that extra foot or 2 foot advantage so you can extend your arms, so that you can extend your body. You can get a little curl on the ball, whatever it is, and get it in there. So creating passing lanes are huge and when we're talking about pivots. Next is passing. There's a couple of things that go with this. And we all work on passing, but I hear coaches oftentimes complain about turnovers. How do I eliminate turnovers? My team is they don't look to see where they're passing it. They don't take care of the ball very well, things like that. And a lot of times this is lower level stuff. We're talking seventh, eighth, ninth graders, but I've heard varsity coaches say the same thing, that they're just too many turnovers. And passing is a skill that needs to be worked on, but there are a few things we can do to help our players know when to pass, when not to pass, and get themselves in good situations. So the first is, can you see the player's hands or can you see the player's numbers? If you can't see their hands or their numbers, it's probably not a pass that you need to make. So even if it's on a fast break, it's on a fast break and you're seeing the guy's shoulder and you're not seeing two hands up in the air ready to pass it, or you're not seeing the guy's number on the front of his chest or the lady's number on the front of her chest, don't pass the ball. When you give them that rule, you automatically eliminate maybe a scoring opportunity if it's on a fast break, but you keep control of the ball. So ask yourself, if we're turning the ball over 50% of the time, we have fast break opportunities. That's too much. So keep the ball 100% of your possessions instead of giving up 50% of them. So it comes down to the numbers. How are you going to stay in this game if turnovers are plaguing your team? It's going to be eliminate turnovers. How do we eliminate turnovers? We give them simple rules to follow. Did you see the player's hands? If their hands weren't up and open, don't pass it. Did you see the player's number on their chest? We need to see both of those things. Okay. And of course, there are some times where players just wide open and you can throw it down the court and get a layup, that kind of thing. But I'm talking about when there's a defender in the way and they're having to make decisions. If you're not a good passing team, give them some parameters. Next is use those pivots to create pass lanes. This is going to be in the half court or after a rebound. I don't know how many times I've seen a big guy grab the rebound, turn and throw it to their outlet, but they didn't turn their whole body. They didn't pivot. Therefore, their pass was kind of weak. It was a little bit of a lob. It gets picked off, and now the other team has the ball again. So a good pivot would have put them in a situation where they could have made a good, strong pass. So it works on both ends. When you're first getting the ball to open up into transition, or you're in your half court set and you're trying to run your offense. Third, know when to bounce pass, chest pass, and overhead pass. These things are things that you have to coach them in practice, that you have to get going, that you have to make sure that the players understand. Bounce passes are great for getting the ball into the post. Chest pass, and I'm not talking traditional chest pass. You rarely see after, you know, the youth level, a two-handed chest, true chest pass. But you have a pass at the chest level, might be with one hand, but where you're really swinging the ball fast, you're really trying to get it to somebody. So that's what I'm talking about when I say chest pass. And then the overhead pass, that long pass down the court to somebody after a rebound. Maybe it's after a made basket, you're taking the ball out of bounds. But knowing when to use those. The other thing is know when and how to use a one-handed pass. That used to be that you don't ever throw the one-handed pass because you can't take it back. And I'm probably an 85% of the time coach where one-handed passes, I don't want them. And I don't want them because players get this idea in their hands where they're going to throw the ball and then they don't like it anymore, but they don't have the ability to take the ball back. So that ball is gone and it's going to be a turnover most of the time. So, but can you use a one-handed pass? Certainly. There are players who are capable of doing one-handed passes. There are players who use it very effectively. And these are my 15% guys. These are the players who have kind of exceptional abilities and see the floor extremely well. They're going to make some passes and do some things that 85% of the players on the floor can't do. So know how and when to use a one-handed pass. And you have to coach players. If they aren't able to do that, tell them that's not a pass you should be making. You need two hands on the ball. Remember, we want to stay in close games. We want to keep possessions alive. We want to give ourselves a chance to score. All of those things mean that we have to protect the basketball. One simple way to do that is to tell 85% of your guys you can't make a one-handed pass and tell that 15% of the players you can make a one-handed pass. That will eliminate things and keep that ball and that possession alive for you so you have a chance to win. So if you're taking over a program and you're trying to rebuild a culture and you're trying to get it back on track, the fastest way to kind of demoralize everybody and to derail things is to let them turn the ball over. You let them turn it over, they'll lose. When they lose, they don't think they're any good. When they don't think they're any good, they're not going to believe in what you're doing. If you want players and you want a team to actually have a chance and you want to turn that culture around, you want to turn the level of play around in the program, eliminate turnovers and you'll automatically start competing with teams that you hadn't competed with before. You give yourself a chance to win some games that you maybe hadn't won before. Doesn't mean you're going to go undefeated or you're going to win a championship right away, but it puts you in the path of players believing in what you're doing, your culture starting to change, and ultimately you're winning more games and you're competing at a higher level. Weak side rebounding is another one, and this is one I put on here from personal experience. We lost a regional game when I was coaching in college because our weak side rebound was so bad. It was actually the one that sticks out at the end of the game, and it wasn't the last second play, but it was towards the end of the game, and my point guard doesn't drop down to the weak side fast enough, gets himself caught under the bucket. One of their bigs is able to rebound and get a put back over us. If we had rebounded that ball, we would have had a lead going into, you know, the last possession or two and giving ourselves a much better chance of winning. And ultimately we lost. And that's the play that sticks out in my mind, that if I had done a better job coaching and just teaching the repetitiveness and the necessity of weak side rebounding, that game would have been ours. So I took that as a coaching loss more than a player loss, because I hadn't emphasized it as much. Of course they knew it to do, but it wasn't something that we had spent a lot of time on. And when it counted most, we missed our opportunity. But we need to know whose responsibility is it? Who's supposed to be down there? In the story I just gave, the point guard was down there. We knew whose responsibility it was. So we had that one checked off. But oftentimes, if players don't rotate down, there's weak side rebounds because they didn't know they were supposed to be there. The second thing is, where should the player make contact? This is where I made my mistake. And this is, I coach this a lot differently now. All of my players know, we go over, when a long shot is taken from the three-point line, it typically lands about 10 feet outside the rim. So if it's shot on one side, almost everybody knows that the rebound, you know, about 70% of the time goes to the opposite side of the floor. So if we know that 70% of the time the ball is going to rebound on the opposite side of the floor, and now we know that most long shots land roughly 10 feet outside the rim, I tell my players, this is where we need to be when we weak side rebound. We need to be outside the lane, and we need to make contact roughly 10 feet, if not a little further, 12 feet from the basket. That gives us the best chance. Now, if there's a big guy on that low block, we're gonna stand right there on the low block. But the way teams starting to play with five out or four out, there's not somebody on the low block all the time. So you're rebounding against a perimeter player who's coming in from the three-point line. You need to meet them 10 to 12 feet outside the rim and have the best chance at rebounding that long shot on the weak side. So we go over that with our players. We incorporate that into what we do in our shooting drills so that players understand. We point that out in film if somebody misses it. We have not had too many poor weak side rebounding teams because we've explained it to them in that manner. This is where the shot's taken. This is where it's likely to be rebounded. If it's rebounded there, we know it's going to land 10 to 12 feet out. This is where you need to be. And now it's up to them to execute. All right. So we've got the first and second bolts there. And then the second thing, it needs to be automatic. And if you do it enough, players will automatically be that weak side rebounder so that you don't get beat. Now, if you play a zone, sometimes the zone shifting can be a little bit different, but players still need to know those first two things so that you can do it automatically. But weak side rebounds, I can't tell you how many times I watch film and I am trying to scout an opponent and get ready. And when I see that they don't weak side rebound well, that's an emphasis of mine. We need to get on the, we need to crash the boards on the weak side. They're not going to get there and stop us if we miss a shot. And there's been more times than not that when we've practiced it and we go into the game, we get 6-8 points off weak side rebounds because nobody's there. It's hard for teams to compete if they're not going to get on that weak side and rebound and block out. The next skill that we want to look at, pump fakes. And this is one that I constantly am trying to improve on. We do talk about it a lot, but players, I think when they go and do their shooting on their own, they go into the gym on their own, they go to the park on their own, maybe if they work with a trainer, not sure, not in all those training sessions, but pump fakes get left to the outside. They work on their shot so much, or they work on their dribble drive and their pull-up so much. The shot fake and the pump fake aren't there. Post players too. They get the ball down low. They want to go right back up and score. And sometimes that's the right move. Other times there's got to be a pump fake. And then you got to go into it because you get the timing of the defense off. And when they're off, they get a chance for a foul, all of that stuff. But the pump fake and shot fake, I'm going to put in the same category together. But they've got to look like the beginning of the player's shot. And that's what we emphasize to the players. And this is something that we're going to emphasize more this year is you have to do these in your workouts as well. Don't just do them in the season because there's not enough of a habit that's formed. They shoot so much. And I use a 10,000 number. I don't necessarily agree with the 10,000, a number that is thrown out there. I think the author, Malcolm Gladwell, was the one who put that out there. But if you do something 10,000 times, you've kind of got it ingrained in you. And then you hear me say throughout a season, we've got to do shot fakes, we got to use pump fakes. And maybe we get like, I don't know, 500 times. It's not going to be as ingrained in you as you'd like it to be if you're just doing it when the coach is telling you. So this is something that we've got to add because we're doing it so much more often when we're not with the coach. But don't start the driving motion while pump faking. That would be another one. Is I see a lot of players do that, and they do it to try to be fast. What they end up doing is traveling. This was really evident when I was coaching in college. Players would do a shot fake and start their motion to drive at the same time. And most of the time they get called for a travel. The shot fake, your feet should be planted like you're going to be shooting it. And then that the movement comes up. And when you come down, now you attack, you know, an outside leg, you attack quickly. But hopefully you've gotten them off the ground or you've gotten them to start that jumping motion, the defense to start that jumping motion. So you don't have to be, you know, the fastest person on the floor to get around them because they've already taken themselves out of the play. But you have to have a good shot fake or a good pump fake to get them up first. The third thing is it needs to be short and quick. I see oftentimes that the shot fake is way too long. players who start with their shot below their waist and then they're going to bring it all the way up. That's too long. You aren't going to fake anybody out like that. Players who bring the ball across their body, they want to go across their body and then try to go into a drive motion or something. It doesn't work because it's not a believable shot. It needs to be right in your shooting pocket. So you get that thing right about, you know, stomach level or so, and you're coming up to your chest and up to the bottom of your chin with the ball. And, you know, your head can go into that fake a little bit. That makes it look like a shot that you would take normally. That's all it has to be. We're talking about moving that ball maybe 2 feet and then going into your drive or sidestepping, whatever it is. And that leads to the next and the final one with pump fakes is know the options after pump fake. Are your players practicing the pump fake into something, into a side dribble, right or left, depending on where the defense kind of flew by them? Are they practicing that forward dribble? And the forward dribble will go into a jump shot. We had a player this year who is exceptional at pump faking from the three-point line, and he shot like 70% from 15-foot range. He was just incredible. 40%, 42% three-point shooter, but just an incredible 15-foot shooter. And we let him shoot that shot quite often because they had to respect his ability to shoot the three. When he pump faked, they went by him. He took one dribble in, shot the 15-footer. He wasn't tall enough to finish at the basket. And we shot such a high percentage. It was great. But beginning of the year, he was trying to drive to the basket, wasn't getting the foul calls. He was missing too many layups. We kind of said, you got to stop that. You need to start shooting that 15-footer. Started shooting it. Scoring percentage skyrocketed. Believe it or not, his three-point percentage also went up. He was shooting in the mid-20s for shooting percentage, and he was shooting at a clip of probably 4 or 5 three-pointers a game. So we're making one out of five every game. Not real good. We put that shot fake in. We got him from driving all the way to the hoop to pulling up for that 15-footer. His three-point percentage, he started selecting a much better three-point percentage. He ended up in the low 40%, 42%, I think it was. And then, of course, his 15-foot percentage was an incredible mark, right around that 70% mark. So know when to go into a jump shot. But if you got a slasher, we had a kid on the opposite side, pump fake, and he could get to the basket. He could finish extremely well. 15-footer was not his game. We did not want him shooting that. So we need to know the player's strengths, and we need to coach him to those strengths. So they need to know, what do you want them to do? Are they going to side dribble? Are they going to forward dribble? And if they're forward dribbling, what level are they trying to get to, the next level to shoot it or all the way to the rim? All right. The last one that we have here is movement without the ball. And this one can be really hard to do, because especially if you're only seeing the kids in season, if you're not getting any workouts in the off season, if they're not playing any travel ball, or they're not playing on a club team, something like that. Movement without the ball. But this is what will make your team go to a new level because they'll understand the game so much better. Backdoor cuts open things up tremendously. We scored on several backdoor cuts this year. That was an emphasis for us because our movement without the ball had to be better for us to compete. We did not have, like I said in the beginning, a stud athlete to go to. So what do? We find other ways to start moving the defense. And backdoor cuts are one way we could do that and get us into a scoring position. Create gaps in space. We want to be able to create gaps in space, and movement without the ball will do both of those things. They'll create a driving lane for a person with the ball because there's a gap that's there. They'll also create space by maybe drifting down the three-point line so there could be a drive and kick, or replacing where the drive came from so there could be a kickback. Lots of different things that can happen there, but those gaps in space allow for the offense to have decisions made on what the defense does. Okay. And then that leads us to our second thing is this creates two actions for a defender to guard. Our two actions have to be something, you know, there's going to be a drive. So the defender has to decide, am I going to close the gap or am I going to stay home on the shooter? He can't do both simultaneously. So two things, if it's the pick and roll, are we going to stay with the ball as it comes over the top of the screen? Or are we going to go with the roll man? We've got to make them decide what of the two actions are they going to guard. If our spacing isn't correct, if we don't have gaps, we can't have that defender make any decisions. But then it's up to our offense to say, all right, this is the decision the defender made. This is what I can use. That's where small-sided games really come into this. The next thing here is take a defender away from the ball. So if they're going to choose we're going to stay with the shooter, then great. The more you space out, the more they're going to be away from the shooter. The more you cut through, the more they're going to follow you through on the cut. And they're not, because you're the shooter, they're not going to be able to stay with the ball. So again, having to make decisions as to what they're going to do. And then lastly, it takes a defender's eyes away from the ball or their player. So things like backdoor cuts, they're watching the ball, a backdoor cut, they can't see you. If they're watching you as the shooter or you as the postman, when they move to see where you are, they cannot guard the ball. So we need to teach our players, not only are we moving without the ball, we're seeing where our defender is looking, and then we're moving based upon where our defender is looking. So, and I'm going to give you a few ways that we can do this and we can teach these things, but movement without the ball can be a tough thing, but it's something that certainly is very, very effective. And let's take a look here real quick at how to teach these skills. And these are ways that we do it in our program. We've had a lot of success with this, and I think this is built throughout the program. So it's not just when they get to the varsity level, but this is starting at the younger ages and moving on up all the way in. We kind of look at the very basics of it. Our youth league is 3-on-3 because we get more movement. We get more touches, more dribbles, more shots, more rebounds, more defense, all of those things. We want to make sure that we're getting those at a young level. So they're used to moving without the ball. They're used to having to do a lot of actions repetitively. And then when they get up to the high school, middle school, and high school level, they already have that skill down because those are skills. And if they have them, we don't have to spend the time, as much time working on them. We refine them at that point. So here are the six ways that we can teach each skill. One is play a lot of 3-on-3. Like I said, that's what we do with our youth program. And then you can build up into 4-on-4 into 5-on-5 with that. Second, play 4 versus 3, give the offense an advantage. So 4v3. Is going to mean that if a player without the ball is moving, if you're not being guarded, you need to be moving to the open space. You're constantly looking for the open space. And when you're looking for it, you will naturally start to do that when it's 4 versus 4. So you'd build that up to a 4 versus 4. And now you start to see where the defense, when they make a mistake, and where you can capitalize on it. Third, incorporate concepts into open gyms and workout sessions. This is huge. If you're doing workout sessions, small groups, individual workouts, you need to incorporate these skills. Find out what your players need to work on. Every player, I can tell you, needs to work on pivoting, needs to work on jump stops, needs to work on their passing. But incorporate those things into each workout. It doesn't have to be the entire workout. It just has to supplement the workout so that the player is getting a little bit here and there all the time. Open gyms, we like to run open gyms, and we like to give an emphasis of you can't score until this happens. You can't score until we get a backdoor cut. You can't score until we get three passes. You can't score until you shift the defense with a loop. Whatever it is that we're trying to do, you can't score until you get 2 feet into the paint and pass and kick it out. If you give them that parameter, now they're forced to do it. They're forced to have to understand the game, and then they can play from there. Fourth thing is emphasize the skill. You want to remember that players will do what you emphasize, not what you think is a good idea, what you emphasize in practice. If you're not emphasizing jump stops, if you're not emphasizing movement without the ball, if you're not emphasizing pivots, that's when it starts to get sloppy. And that's why these things are skills that win games, because you're emphasizing the things that keep the ball in your hands, that keep the possession going, that keep your team or give your team a chance to score. And when you emphasize that in practice, they will do it in the games. Because remember, that's an extension of your practice is what they're doing in the game. So if they're turning it over in the games, guess what? Probably not emphasizing the right things or not emphasizing it enough in practice. And I don't mean emphasize by when you're getting them on the line to run. Running has never made anybody better at pivoting. Running has never made anybody better at getting a 2-foot jump stop. Can it get a player's attention? Certainly it can. But running, it's not a punishment. It's a matter of, it's a turnover. We blow the whistle. You didn't do what we had to. The ball turned over to the other side. That's what happens in a game. So we want to emphasize what will happen in a game, and the players will start to understand it. Show it to them in game film. If they don't believe you, show it to them in practice film, if you film your practices, and let them see that this is what we're trying to eliminate because this is what's taking us out of games. Fifth is use similar terminology throughout your program. So whether you're 9th grade, 10th grade, or you're a varsity coach, you're a middle school coach, find out what terminology is being used at the varsity level and use that throughout the program. Now players are going to start to recognize that common language is going to be easier to understand. And then lastly is teach these skills beginning at an early level. We do it through our youth program. We've got kind of a system of how we do our youth league in the winter, how we do our youth camps in the summertime, how we teach things to our freshmen that are just coming in. So they're going from eighth grade to ninth grade, and then the succession of what they're doing in middle school to high school gets a little bit more complicated and a little more in depth. And that, you know, keeps your kids playing at a high level. So teach these skills at the beginning, at an early age, at an early level. That way you can build on them. If you're just coming into a program, doesn't mean you can't teach them right now, but it may take a year or two. I've always said that the second year is really the year you should see the most growth with your team, because especially the varsity level I'm talking about, because you'll have returners who have already had you 1 year. They understand what you want and they can bring the next group of guys along. The first year you're in that position, the first year can be the hardest year, because players, while they have the best of intentions and are trying as hard as they can, they haven't ingrained the habits in themselves yet. And when they don't have the habits, the thought process takes a little longer. That means the reactions are a little slower and you don't get quite the same level of play as you do with that second year guy. So a second year, if a coach is taking over a program, that's when you want to see the biggest amount of growth. So those are the six ways to teach each skill.
Coach, I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Coaching Lab podcast. If you ever want to attend a Friday Coaches Clinic, just head over to CoachMattDennis.com to find out when the next one is. If you can't make it live, make sure that you sign up, because I send out a replay as well as any of the resources that I show or I talk about during the session.
Thanks for listening to today's episode, Coach. If you'd like more great coaching content, I encourage you to check out the Coaching Lab at CoachMattDennis.com. You'll find everything you need to have more success in less time.